able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised.
Pardon me, Gil. Pardon me. But no, the revolution is being televised. That's right. On Free Speech TV. And if you care anything about truth and justice and democracy, tune in to freespeech.org on the internet, because the revolution is being televised. Check it out sometime if you get a chance, huh? And right now, ladies and gentlemen, a good friend of this show and these airwaves, and a great friend to all humanity, Mr. Paul George from Peninsula Peace and Justice. Paul, welcome back to KZSU.
As always, happy to be here, Bert.
And Paul, you agree.
So now we're putting the revolution out on the radio, right?
Sure, it's being broadcast, isn't
That's
it?
That's right.
You know, and you'd agree with that statement, wouldn't you? That I've been thinking about that lately. It's like, that was a theme song of the 60s and the 70s, right? The revolution will not be televised.
Uh-huh.
And Gil Scott-Heron had a great point with that song, but it is now being broadcast and televised, isn't it?
Media has gone viral. I almost didn't use that word. I hate that word, actually. But
well, it fit in that case, didn't it?
It fits, yeah.
Paul George, you're the director of Peninsula Peace and Justice, and been doing some amazing work, especially recently. Last October, you brought Noam Chomsky to Palo Alto,
right,
and filled Gunn High School's Spangenberg Theater.
Yeah, 1,000 people.
Amazing. What a turnout, huh?
Yeah.
And then, did a lot in between then, too, but 2 weeks ago, you brought Rosemond Jolissant and Kenny Neal to a fundraiser for Haiti.
Yeah, it's just a little over a week ago.
Yeah, and we had Rosemond up on the show last Monday. He came by and played for the folks, and that
very
was
cool.
It was amazing you were able to bring him out to the Bay Area.
Yeah, well, he's been touring all around the country to raise money for earthquake relief in Haiti. He's hooked up with a group called Soil down there that works on organic fertilizers from latrines, basically, and
very cool,
refertilizing Haiti's soil.
Do you got any kind of update on not just his exploits, but the Haiti Relief Fund, and you sent the money off that you were able to get from the benefit?
Back it came out to about $1,700 for each group. We raised money for two groups, for Soil and for Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, HERF. So I haven't heard any recent reports. On Facebook, somebody just posted a photo of one of our former board members, Paul Namphy, who's Haitian, along with Sasha Kramer, who runs Soil, and was a Stanford student here, and after graduating, went down to Haiti and set up the Soil project. So a nice picture of the two of them together down there in Haiti. But no update.
Cool. Well, I did meet one of the board members, too, Jennifer. I don't want to mispronounce her last name, but she's on the board of the Soil Project.
Yeah, Jenny Ben Orden.
There you go.
Yeah.
And I guess we're going to try to have her on the show up here, but that sounds like a wonderful ongoing project, especially for Haiti. Because
it's really creative, and she's caught the attention. You know, Nicholas Kristof, with the columnist for the New York Times.
Oh, really?
Does a lot of traveling around to the third world, and he's always looking for creative projects like that. And he featured Soil in one of his columns, and then at the end of the year, recommended it as a good place for people to donate. So
we talked a little bit about that last time you were on the show, that the Haitian people, a lot of times the Haitian people get blamed for, they cut down all the trees on the island. What's wrong with those people? They don't know what they're doing. They cut down the trees and make charcoal. And it turns out they were forced into becoming cheap labor for sweatshops.
Right.
When it turns out before then, all through the 1800s and the early 1900s, they were a great agrarian society. They were a farm-based society. They grew all their own food. They exported food too, right?
That's right. Yeah, it was mostly at the urging of the United States and corporate powers up here that encouraged the Duvalier dictatorship to convert to an export-oriented economy and manufacturing. And That's what they did, and they started setting up sweatshops, and in the meantime, food aid going in, cheap rice going in from the United States undermined Haiti's indigenous rice industry, and they couldn't compete price-wise, and all these things combined to drive a lot of people out of the countryside and into the cities, basically Port-au-Prince. Mm-hmm. And that's why there were so many people there when that terrible earthquake hit. Basically, economic policy of the United States for the last generation.
Tragic. Totally tragic, for sure. So, Paul, what's on your mind today? This is International Women's Day.
It is indeed.
And you got any observances about that?
Well, I hadn't come prepared about that because I wasn't really thinking about the date when I got up this morning. So
I wasn't either until I turned on Democracy Now! And she kind of shamed me.
Uh-huh.
I went, oh, that's what today is. But what'd you bring today, Paul?
Well, there's a couple of things going on. First of all, major activity coming up toward the end of the month on March 20th. Going to be a big march and rally against the ongoing occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq. This is the annual gathering. It's going to be, in addition to San Francisco, there'll be major marches in New York, Los Angeles, and indeed around the country. It's the seventh anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, March. I guess it was March 21st, but the peace rally this year is Saturday, March 20th, up in San Francisco at the Civic Center. And
they're going to march from Justin Herman Plaza down at the foot of Market Street?
I'm not sure what the march route is right now. I think they're still negotiating that with the San Francisco police.
Who is it that puts these on? Is it a coalition of groups?
Yes. It's just about every peace-oriented group in the Bay Area that send representatives to biweekly meetings. There's been 50 to 100 people coming to the meetings and collectively making the decisions and doing the outreach and that sort of thing. So,
are you involved in that?
One of our board members who lives in San Francisco has been going to the coalition meetings, so I don't have to drag up to San Francisco on a Saturday morning, which I really appreciate. I do go to a lot of coalition meetings in San Francisco, but this time around I allowed someone else to go for me. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we are trying to encourage people to get up there and make a good showing that we still oppose these wars. The troops have to come home.
You think people are weary? The general public, you know, not the part of the public who goes out and marches, and not the activist public, but just the general public. You think they're weary of not just protests, but just a war? And it's been going on now since, like you said, 7 years.
7 years for Iraq, and you know we're coming up to 9 years in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's really been kind of, you know, both wars, both occupations have been pretty much pushed off the front pages and up until we had this major offensive in Marja in Afghanistan that generated a lot of news. But, of course, that's...
You hear such slanted stories, too. They just seem to be talking like, well, the insurgents, and then they got on them and they shot them up, and then they're... And it just seems like you get this same line going, you know, well, we're at war against these people that hate us, and so our troops are fighting on every day, and we don't get that real grit that, say, somebody like Democracy Now! Or the folks that Amy Goodman brings on, or Norman Solomon, a guy who you host down here, or quite a few other journalists. We don't hear from those people in the mainstream, do we?
No, not very much. And it'd be interesting to see what the corporate media does this week. One of the things I wanted to mention is that on Wednesday in Congress, I don't really understand the parliamentary procedures here, but Dennis Kucinich, congressman from Ohio, is under some kind of personal privilege, has been able to force a vote based on the War Powers Act. about Afghanistan. And it's basically going to be a yes or no vote on the Afghanistan war.
Yeah.
It is not expected to pass, but it is an important procedure, I think,
for Dennis
to bring this
right?
up, because later in the spring, we don't know exactly when yet, but the administration is going to have to come to Congress for supplemental spending,
more money.
Yep, $33 billion is what's going to be in the bill.
Did you say billion?
Yes, and that's going to be a really critical vote. And so, you know, this march and rally coming up on March 20th, the Kucinich maneuver this Wednesday. These all need to be seen as building blocks coming up to that vote. Because a lot of people like Russ Feingold in the Senate will be trying to use the supplemental spending vote to set a date certain for withdrawal. And, you know, what we have now is a promise of next year to begin withdrawal. And the hope is that Congress will tighten that up and set a date certain that to get out, and do that through the supplemental spending bill. So now is the time to get Afghanistan and Iraq back on the front pages, or at least back on the top of our own agendas, and be contacting Congress about the Kucinich vote on Wednesday, and the whenever the supplemental spending bill comes up. It'll be pretty soon, probably in April, maybe May. $33 billion, and see how the media covers that, and more importantly, what activists do, because anti-war activism has hit a low ebb. We got to be honest about that.
I think people are weary, you know. But a big question in my mind when you just said that, we keep getting hit with these numbers every time. Billion, billion, 33 billion, 50 billion. It was 18 billion a month in Iraq for all those years, right? They just seem... So, I think we've gotten...
Yeah, $100 billion a year just for Afghanistan.
There you $100 go, yeah.
billion a year. And
we've gotten numb to those numbers, and now they have this big healthcare debate, and the folks on the right are the first ones to say, well, wait a minute, how are you going to pay for it?
Right.
We can't afford that.
Right.
But they're the first ones to vote, and I'm not just talking about the right, because I think the right and the left both are kind of playing us like a violin, but... They're telling us that we can't afford health care,
right?
But they can afford to send 30. Where are they going to get $33 billion anyway? We're broke, right?
Well, they don't care. You know, when it comes to that, they don't insist that you pay as you go, and that's the way it's been since the initial invasion of Afghanistan and then the invasion of Iraq.
And the American people haven't spoken about it either, have we?
These are major additions to the federal deficit that the Republicans are crying about. But nobody cared about finding the money to pay for it when we went to war or continuing.
Right. But the Democrats are also too scared to oppose it in fear of being called...
soft on terrorism, yeah.
Right.
Right.
So it's kind of a conundrum here. And the American people. Now, Paul, you being a lifelong activist, and I kind of am aware of this too, what would it take, and I feel it's not that much, if the American people, say a majority of them, just got on the phone and on the email in a 5 or 7 day period and let it be known how they really felt, could that make a difference?
Well, you like to think so. I mean, it's supposed to be a representative democracy. I think history shows that Congress, especially in an election year, can be responsive to the people, especially when there is such an outpouring.
Because the silent majority hasn't been heard from. The majority of the American people, they're told every night how they feel and how they think by the major news media, but we haven't heard from them. Right? And I'm part of them. You're part of them.
Yeah.
We're speaking right now, but I mean, where's everybody else?
You know, if you think back to the closing days of the Bush administration when the economy was first tanking and everybody is saying, you know, we've got to pass this stimulus bill.
Mm-hmm.
But there was such an outcry from around the country.
Yeah.
that it went down to defeat, and they had to go back and try again. So, you know, that's a recent example of...
It worked.
It worked.
Enough people stood up and called. They just called an email, too. They didn't even... they didn't have to get up and drive or take the bus or fly.
That's right.
They just emailed and called, and Congress, especially Congress, got very terrified, didn't they?
Yeah, they sure did. And, you know, so that's what we need to do coming up to these, as Congress approaches votes on continuing these occupations in Afghanistan and Iraq, is to let people know again that get people re-energized to be calling Congress and flooding Congress with phone calls and emails.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is something that we're certainly going to be focusing on at the Peace and Justice Center in the coming couple of months, including this week's vote by it's being forced by Dennis Kucinich. So...
You know, another thing that strikes me real funny, Paul, is in the wake of 2-3 weeks ago, in the wake of what's being said as Barack Obama's health care bill, but it's really not. He's trying to push a bill. He's trying to push the Senate and the Congress to pass something. Mm-hmm. It's not his bill. He didn't write it. But we're being told it's his bill of Obamacare and all that. Right. And in the wake of that looking like it wasn't going to pass, we saw all these healthcare providers, these insurance companies, raise their rates.
Yeah.
Right? Right across the board, not just California, but especially in California, they were maybe the first one, but Michigan, state by state, they've been raising them. And it's almost like a second slap in the face to the American people. And I can't help but think, is somebody trying to wake us up? I mean, because we're, you know, somebody's actually slapping us right in the face.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Insult to injury.
Yeah. You know, I wonder why the insurance companies chose this particular time to make these really outrageous increases. You know, Obama is out on the campaign trail, basically. I think he's in Pennsylvania today, and he gave a speech just this morning, and that was kind of his main theme was... how much higher do the rates have to go before we're going to realize that it's time to call a halt to this?
Mm-hmm.
So, what was the one here in California? Anthem Blue Shield, I think it's called. 39% increase.
That's insane.
Yeah, it is insane. I know my own premiums have been going up 10 to 15% every year for the past 10 years or so. Which is pretty outrageous. I mean, you know, we haven't had inflation. The cost of living has not gone up more than fractions of a percent over the last several years. So, you know, and healthcare is going up 10, 15, 39% in the case of Blue Shield.
Well, the big insult in that was, didn't they report a massive profit for that one quarter? Wasn't it something like several billion, $2 or $3 or $4 billion for a quarter?
Yeah, yeah.
They had this big profit, and then, oh, yeah, but we're going to raise your rates.
Yeah. Insurance is an extremely profitable business. And
you know, you and I are old enough to remember when you were in school, grade school, okay, and I grew up around here. You grew up on the East Coast. But back then, our parents would take us to the doctor. Healthcare was always non-profit. There was never profit mentioned as far as healthcare went. Everybody had a plan, and there was, I don't know, Kaiser was out here. Kaiser was one of them, and then there was other community hospitals. Kaiser had quite a network out here. They weren't as big as they are now, but whatever was going on the East Coast, I'm sure there was, you know, whatever your family had. But profit was never part of it. And if you even mentioned profit as part of the healthcare thing back then, you just get laughed out of the room. And we found out from Michael Moore's movie Sicko, exactly at the point in politics, American politics, where it all changed, Richard Nixon got told about these new things called HMOs, uh-huh. Health Maintenance Organizations, and Michael Moore was able to actually call the tape, the actual recording, whatever one of his aides brought it in and said, no, you're going to have a meeting with this guy, and we're going to change the whole thing. And we see there, that's where profit got brought in. And I wonder if there's some way that the debate could be changed and we could say, wait a minute, why don't we take it back a few notches to the point in time where we didn't even have profit in healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like England and like Canada and like France and like all the other industrialized countries of the world, they don't have profit in their healthcare. And whether they're the best situations or not, we don't need to debate that. It's that nobody profits from it. Everybody gets taken care of, right?
Yeah, well, I think that is finally making it into the debate this time around. You know, this has been going on for over a year now, and a lot of the messages have been scrambled. The wacko right has seized the message for quite a long time last summer with their death panels and, you know, all this crazy
stuff. Well,
they
morphed into the tea parties, and they're still there, though.
And
Sarah Palin's still around.
But, you know, I think the White House is finally getting their message focused. Obama is out really pushing hard now on the health care reform. And, you know, when you look at what's been going on in Washington, around this healthcare reform, the bill that the broad outlines of what we think is going to be the final bill that'll get a vote sometime in the next couple of weeks, maybe. It's not the kind of thing you would go out and design, but I've become convinced that we have to support passage of this bill, and then work our efforts to fix it up and improve it in the coming years.
Really? I was going to ask you about that.
You know, this is it's a tough one because there's a lot of stuff in there that people, you know, progressives are not going to like.
It's not single payer. There's not even a public option.
Well, yeah, and there's no public option.
That means we're all going to be forced to have health insurance that maybe we can't afford.
But here's the thing. It will cover 30 million people who aren't covered now. And when you consider that 40,000 people a year die due to lack of health insurance, I think that's a pretty important step forward. And out of those 30 million, about half of them will be covered through Medicaid and Medicare, which is a public health program.
Now, who are these 30 million? Are they people that couldn't afford insurance?
That's right. That do not have insurance right now. There's something like 50 million uninsured.
Where's the cutoff, though? Because suppose you work, but you don't make that much money. Okay, is there a cutoff where... okay, if I'm forced to buy insurance, salary isn't that high.
There will be government subsidies to help people who can't afford the premiums. So, you know, there is...
So the insurance companies are allowed to charge us whatever they want. The government, it is really our money in the long run, right?
Uh-huh.
The government will kick in the rest of the money that we can't afford so the insurance companies can get richer. This is a bill we're hoping will pass?
Well... You know, like I said, there's a lot of problems with this. But, you know, Medicare that people generally like right now, mm-hmm. Which is a public option, did not get passed in its current form when it was first created. It's been, revised many times over the years.
What did it look like when it first started?
The option right now, and, you know, I understand that this is a tough choice for a lot of people, because
mm-hmm.
There is a lot of bad stuff in this bill. There's no doubt about it.
It's the Senate bill.
But, the last time any major effort was made for healthcare reform, which we all agree is absolutely critical, we were just talking about, you know, the premiums going up, people being denied coverage. 40,000 people a year dying because they don't have coverage, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The last time it was tried was in 1994. That was 16 years ago. We cannot see this go down and wait 16 years to try again. It's a tough call because there is a lot of junk in the bill, but there's a lot of good stuff in the bill as well. And it's the old cliche, you've got to get your foot in the door. It's a tough decision, but if they beat it back this time, and by they, I mean the insurance companies and, you know, the for-profit hospital corporations and things like that, we'll have handed them another victory, and we'll go on with this busted, unsustainable system for who knows how long, because... You know, it's going to be a long time before another president even tries it. So you know,
we want this bill to pass.
I think the thing to do is let's get it passed and then work our butts off to fix it in the coming years. But if it goes down, there's no chance of getting anything for years and years to come. And so, you know, it's not easy to support a lot of, you know, to say vote for some of this stuff in the bill.
Modern politics is so funny like that. In fact, it's not even modern politics. It's always been that way.
It's always been that way.
The choice of a lesser evil.
Right.
You don't get the good or the bad.
Yeah, you have to understand, you know, how Washington works. And politics is compromise.
Or doesn't work.
Yeah, or doesn't work. But, you know, it is compromise. You know, we don't have to abandon our support for a single payer system, which is, you know, what we really need, to, you know, give a grudging nod to this current legislation.
What's the current pulp? And
there's stuff, you know, I can't get beyond the fact that it's going to cover 30 million people who currently aren't covered. That's a really big step forward. And, you know, putting half of those 30 million people into Medicaid or Medicare, which are public programs, you know, so it will be a big step forward. And mostly it will be that if something doesn't pass, the hopes of reforming the system, you think, you know, these insurance companies are tromping all over us now. If they win this one, you know, there's nothing to hold them back.
The sky's the limit, huh?
Instead of the 39% you know, rate increase, you're going to see 69% rate increase, because there's no one to stop them. They, they'll have demonstrated that they own Washington, that you can't do anything to control the insurance companies. And this is another good aspect of the bill, is reforming how insurance companies work to begin with, not allowing insurance companies to deny coverage for pre-existing conditions, or when you develop a condition and you do have insurance, they kick you off.
It says they can't do that in there?
That's right. It's, you know, it could be a lot stronger on reforms of the insurance industry, but the reforms that are in there that do seem acceptable and passable are really important. And, you know, if you had ever, you know, been denied insurance or gotten kicked out of your program because you developed a condition, you'd be all for this just on that one point, if you had experienced the trauma of something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as always, it's a tough call to call for compromise. I wouldn't be saying this if we were talking about a vote on the Afghanistan war. To me, there's only one way there. You got to get out now. But this is domestic policy, and it's going to have a huge impact on the future going forward. And I can see that, you know, if this passes, there will be bills in every Congress coming up to fix this, fix that, and more attempts at putting a public option in. Just because a flawed bill passes doesn't mean it's written stone forever and ever. People will go back and revisit and fix and add to it. Like I said with Medicare, you know, Medicare was not the system it is now when it was first passed by Congress. They have gone back and improved it time and time again. And that's the future with this admittedly flawed health care bill. But if it doesn't pass, there is no hope for doing anything rational in the near future.
Anytime I hear somebody on the right talk about this subject right now, that they say the American people are against this. They want to shut it down. They have spoken, but you're not listening. Then when I hear people on the left, and I'm talking about the mainstream media, Fox, CNN, MSNBC, when I hear it over on the right, they say the American people have spoken. The majority of American people don't want this to happen. And then when I go over and listen on the left, they say, no, 70% of the American people want a single-payer system. Do we know what the real number is, or can we get close on what the American people really want? Do we know?
I have seen some polls that kind of break down the major elements of the various bills and things that have been moving through Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, the public option has something like 70% support. I'm trying to remember which this particular poll was, but I'm not going to be able to give you a citation.
A number I've heard too.
But on all the various major elements of this bill, the insurance company reform, vast majority of support. Public option, vast majority of support. A Medicare buy-in sort of thing, which I don't think is going to end up in this bill. Big public support.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Republicans won the Senate seat in Massachusetts when Ted Kennedy died, and they're trying to apply that to the whole country. Part of it is I think Obama did not do a good job getting the message out. It's complex, so it's not an easy message. I think since the Massachusetts election back in January, it was a real wake-up call for him. And
wasn't that kind of a sham, though? Because when George Bush in the last administration wanted to pass something, they just kind of rammed it through, and they didn't need 60 votes.
No.
And they just did it, and if it was shameful, if it was bad, they didn't care. They just did it, right? And we a lot of people on the left grumbled, but it got passed, and then it became a Patriot Act, a lot of different stuff like that. And now the Democrats, I don't know if it's the Democrats or the news media, but they've told us, oh, well, Kennedy's seat went to a Republican, so they don't have the votes anymore. So, but it turns out they don't need 60 votes. They could do it with like 51, can't they?
Yes.
What's the deal on that?
Through what's called the reconciliation process.
Do they not want to do that?
And, you know, this is in the Senate. I think they're going to have to do it that way because obviously they're not going to get 60 votes in the Senate. And
does that make it a weaker bill? Or
it's some things can't be passed through reconciliation because reconciliation... anything passed under reconciliation has to have an impact on the federal budget, expenditures or income. So some things aren't permissible under reconciliation. And so you don't get a complete bill that way.
Hmm.
One of the ways this might work is that, you know, the way Congress works is that the House passed a version.
Mm.
The Senate passed its own version.
Mm-hmm.
And normally those two differing versions would go through a joint committee where they would come up with identical bills because they can't send two different bills. Both houses have to pass identical bills, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's not going to happen this time because there's no agreement. But since the Senate has passed a bill, it's a bit more watered down than the House version.
Mm-hmm.
The House could go back and vote on that same Senate bill and pass it. And then it's law. It goes to the president for signature.
Oh.
And then, you know, you don't have this supermajority requirement in the House. And then they can use reconciliation or other procedures to go through and fix the parts that people want. And that's what they're negotiating in Congress right now. They're trying to get people in the House of Representatives to buy off, first of all, on the trust factor. They're going to vote for something they don't really like, the Senate bill, and then trust that efforts will be made to go back and fix it. Through reconciliation and things like that.
Of course, they're all up for re-election in November, right?
Well, yeah, and
they're probably waiting. They probably want to wait till after November to do that, don't they?
Well,
you know how politicians are, right?
You know, Republicans are going to make health care a major issue one way or the other. And if I was a Democratic representative, I'd want to go back to my constituents and say, we did something for the first time in 30 years to help reform the health care mess in this country, and it's not perfect, and I want you to vote for me and send me back so I can fix it up.
It's not always so black and white. Even if you're a Democrat, you come from whatever state or county or district, you might have a lot of different kind of voices screaming at you about different things, right?
Oh, yeah.
And people that don't know what they're talking about, and people making you look like you're one thing and not another. You know, it's not so cut and dry blue and red, is it?
Well, and you get such a... No, it's not cut and dried. It never is. And there's a lot of people that, you know, swing back and forth. They vote Democratic one election and Republican the next. And,
you know, Are we being played or what?
Well, you know, there really is at times, and this year could be... one of those times when a real throw the bums out mood settles over the country.
But what do you replace them with?
And more bums.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, you also get a lot of distortion coming out of Washington. You know, the Republicans. You use the term, you know, ramming this through.
Sure.
You know, as if a majority vote is ramming something through. You know, we need to remind ourselves that majority rule is kind of, you know, the name of the game in this country.
You would hope.
But this reconciliation process where you don't need the supermajority to cut off a threatened filibuster has been used more by the Republicans in the last 20 years by a factor of about 8-1 than it has by Democrats to pass things.
That's pathetic.
So, but they're going to be out there screaming and yelling that that the Democrats somehow are cheating in the Senate by having a simple majority.
I think most Americans want to just turn it off. Let's shift gears and make it a little more local. What about the governor's race, Paul? It's so funny because it's coming up pretty quick now. It's not like we had like a presidential race where it's 2 years out or a year out. It's coming up in November. California's going to pick its next governor. And we've got the former CEO of eBay. Who is it? Meg Whitman is her name? And she's got multi-zillions of dollars, maybe proving that you can buy political office. I don't know. And then, and she said she's going to use her money to do it. She got millions, right?
Oh, yeah.
More than anybody could ever come up with, and unless Bill Gates got involved. And then did Jerry Brown say he's going to run?
Jerry Brown officially announced, I think it was Thursday or Friday.
And is there another Democrat who's... Because they have to go through a primary thing too, right?
Right. The primary will be in June, and that'll select the two-party candidates.
And is there anybody going up against Jerry Brown? For Gavin Newsom was thinking about it, but he got out of it.
Right. He got out. There's nobody else officially announced right now.
And then you'd think if there was going to be somebody, they would have already, right?
Well, Jerry Brown's a pretty formidable campaigner. I'm not sure, you know,
did anybody want to
go up against him.
And then there is another Republican that's going up against Meg Whitman, right?
Tom Campbell, who used to be our representative in this area.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of him?
I always respected Tom when he was congressman here. I met with him several times. He's a really intelligent guy. When you go to meet with him over certain issues, he really listens, asks questions. Not all meetings with Congress people go like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we had one of our few congressional successes, actually, with Tom Campbell. He was representing this district in the 80s, early 90s, when Central America was such a big issue.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we had met with him often about was congressional aid, military aid to El Salvador, where, you know, this U.S.-backed government was just brutally repressing its own people. And it took a couple of years, but Campbell finally became one of only five Republicans to vote to cut military aid to El Salvador. So, you know, that felt pretty good to bring a congressman along like that. You know, that said, I can respect him, but I'm not always going to agree with all his policies.
He'd make a good governor?
I think he would be a very capable administrator, yeah.
What do you think of Meg Whitman? This is an opinion show, so we
can read
do that
little disclaimer again.
Yeah, right. What do we think of Meg Whitman? She's the CEO of a big multi...
former CEO.
Yeah.
I think Meg Whitman is... how to put it... poster child for why we need public financing of our campaigns here. It drives me crazy that... wealthy people can throw themselves into politics just based on that.
That's a little scary.
And, you know, you have to wonder why she's doing this. You know, when she first announced, it came out, somebody checked their voting records, and she hasn't even voted in most of the elections her whole adult life.
Really?
She's only voted in a couple.
Really?
Yeah.
Could she even be able to run yet?
You know...
Well, no, that'll be a tool that her opponent, whoever it is, will use against her, right? In advertising.
I would hope so.
If they want to win.
Deserves to be pointed out.
And the question is, can California discern? I mean, California did pick Arnold Schwarzenegger, didn't it?
Yeah. That was one of the craziest elections I've ever seen.
And it was never disputed, right? It wasn't like, oh, it was stolen or there was funny stuff with the vote. It was pretty straight up. He won, didn't he?
Yeah. That was definitely a throw-the-bums-out kind of election. And if you remember, it was...
Who ran against him the last time? Because when he got his second term, he just had that one main opponent. First time he got in, it was like 15. Gary Coleman was on the ballot.
Yeah, and Arianna Huffington.
Yeah. It was like 20 different people to pick from. But the last time he ran, he had one opponent. Was it John Guerrero? It escapes both of us.
Yeah.
But I mean, he had an opponent. California still picked him. And California took it on the chin under the Schwarzenegger administration. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Pretty
absolutely.
Heavily. We live here, and we know how it feels. It's tough. It's not the same place since before he got in.
There are a couple other things, California politics-wise, that are going to be very important that are cooking up.
What's that?
In the June, on the June ballot, mm-hmm. there'll be a measure. It's very limited, but it's kind of a test case. If it passes, and... I don't know that it has a number yet, but it's known as the Clean Money Initiative, and it takes the Office of Secretary of State, which is a statewide elected position, and requires public financing for that office, so that if Meg Whitman wanted to run for Secretary of State, she couldn't pile all her own money in there. The candidates are going to get money from the state. That's what they use. Each candidate qualified for the ballot gets the same amount of money.
Just for Secretary of State, though.
But not
for governor.
No, it's a test system, and I actually think it's a pretty good way to approach it, because then you can say public financing can work, and we can get corporations out of our elections. We can get private wealth out of our elections.
Mm-hmm.
It's similar to the healthcare bill and what we were talking about. It's something to build on for the future.
Yeah. Now, speaking of the healthcare bill, Mark Leno from San Francisco, a state assemblyman, has floated two times at least now a bill for single payer healthcare for all California residents.
Yeah,
and we would have had it, but Schwarzenegger vetoed it twice.
Right, and
could we use that as a litmus test for the next governor of California? Could that be something that would be asked of them? Hey, would you be willing to sign that bill?
I think absolutely it should be one because As you mentioned,
it's, that bill's still hanging out there too, right?
Yeah,
ready to run it again.
It has, if I'm correct, it has already passed the Senate in Sacramento.
And so our representatives
and
want
it. It's working its way through the Assembly through various committees. I don't think there's any question that it'll pass again. And I also don't think there's any question that Schwarzenegger would probably veto it again.
Sure. If, so if they probably passes. Won't run it before
so,
November.
Yeah, that should absolutely be. A major issue, and I hope whatever candidate emerges on the Democratic side would make it an issue.
If that passed, would that mean every California resident had health care? Being a California resident, we're
yes.
all covered?
Yes, we would have a single-payer system.
And the state would cover it. It'd just be like tomorrow when I woke up, if it passed tomorrow when I woke up, if I got sick, I'd just go to the hospital. And
it'd be very similar to a Canadian system.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah. You know, back in, what was it, 94, there was a single-payer system on the ballot.
Here in California?
Proposition 86. I worked for that campaign.
Really?
It was, this is why it's ended up in the legislature, because at the time, we raised $5 million for the campaign for Proposition 86, or a single payer. The insurance companies poured $50 million into California to defeat it. And even at that, it wasn't defeated overwhelmingly. It was a fairly close vote, but so that's why the efforts over the years shifted to the legislature, and it has passed the last 2 years only to be vetoed, and it's working its way through again. It was actually started by Sheila Kuhl, who's from over in the Fremont area, and she's no longer in the assembly. She was term limited out or something like
they
that.
They all are eventually, right?
And Mark Leno is.
Does any state have that? Have single payer as a state?
No, not as a state.
So if California did it, we could become the first one.
There are states that have their own forms of health care reform. Massachusetts has a system that's very much like what's being proposed in the U.S. Congress right now.
It's a little scary, right? They mandated everybody to get it. But there's loopholes in it, and it's not a single payer.
It's not a single payer. It definitely needs some fixing, and it hasn't brought down the costs as they were anticipating.
Right. It hurt a lot of people, didn't it?
But it's what they were able to get passed, and, you know, in Massachusetts, just like nationally, what we're talking about here is getting something done first, getting the public used to the idea that we are going to reform healthcare and how it's delivered in this country. And then, you know, with any kind of policy like this, you don't always know how things are going to turn out. You have to go back and fix things. Just like Medicare, as I mentioned a couple of times, was not passed originally the way it exists now.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it exists now, it's a pretty good program. Medicare and Medicaid.
If they pass this bill, this one that's currently before the federal government, could California still pass a single payer and we would be separate from that bill? We wouldn't have to pay attention to the federal. We could just be, hey, no, we have single payer out here.
You know, that's a good question. I think it would still be allowable. The Republicans were trying to put in
A clause that it wouldn't work?
No, they were actually, and I think this ended up in the bill as a way to try to appease some of these Republicans. It's a kind of opt out, so that any state could say, "Well, we're going to opt out of this federal reform system."
Oh,
and you know, so the Republican idea of states' rights and that sort of stuff would actually be beneficial to. You know, getting a single payer system here in California.
Maybe that's what people ought to push for if they really care. And maybe it's better if we break it down to more of a local thing. Is trying to get the whole country to decide on something seems impossible. But a statewide thing, and I'm sure you and I...
Well, that was the idea back in 94 of putting it on the ballot, was that, you know, in California we have this... citizen initiative process where you can put things on the ballot and get the state to vote for it.
And people voted against it, but not by an overwhelming majority.
Right. But the idea was that, you know, California would be a demonstration project for the rest of the country. And the idea was either you pass it state by state, or once you get enough states and people start seeing that this system works, then you can get Congress to pass a single-payer system. Didn't work out that way. So we're still at work on that. Before we run out of time, I want to mention one other California politics thing that is in the works. It's the California Democracy Act. And what's happening right now is signatures are being collected to put this on the ballot. And it's really simple. It's a constitutional change. You know, right now in Sacramento, to pass the budget requires a two-thirds vote.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives the small Republican minority a lot of power. And it's
or any minority, really.
Yeah.
They happen to be Republican now.
And it's that supermajority rule is one of the root causes of the economic mess that this country or this state is in right now.
So what would this bill do?
It changes the Constitution to require just a majority vote.
Which would be, what, 51%?
Yeah. So,
and people are passing around petitions right now?
Right.
People could sign up for it?
Yep. And
you got a website or an address?
Yes. The website is ca4d.org for California for Democracy. So it's ca4d.org. I hadn't known this, but you know how you always see people out on the corners with their clipboards and, mm-hmm. and the ballot measures and collecting signatures.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to that website, you can download a personal form that you can print out, sign it. It's just like one of these ballots, and you mail it in. And it's valid. It's as if you came across somebody out on the street corner and signed on their clipboard.
So you can do it right from home.
You can do it right from home and sign it and send it in. They get mailed into the campaign office, and they're going to collate them all together. I'm not sure when the deadline is to get it qualified for the November ballot. But
and you could forward that to all the friends on your email list, right?
Well, that's what I did. I did this over the weekend and put the link up on my Facebook page and asked people to pass it on. And so, you know, people were saying, I signed it. I put it on my Facebook page and telling all my friends about it.
That could go viral.
Yeah. Well, that's
as
what,
much as you hate to use that word.
That's what we hope, though.
Yeah.
So
that's great.
Yeah. And this whole thing was started by George Lakoff, the UC Berkeley professor. Very outspoken. He's a linguistics professor.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of UC Berkeley's own little Noam Chomsky. He's not as well known as Chomsky, but he is a good, keen political analyst. And he said, you know, this is just nuts. Just like we were talking earlier in the Senate, you know, majority rule, you have to build in protections for minority points of view, but when they're abused like they are being abused by the Republicans in the Senate right now, you have to do something to change things up and give a nod to majority rule once in a while, and
right.
What's supposed to be a majority rule democracy.
And speaking of that, I think the filibuster really took it on the chin last week when
Jim Bunning
used it and denied millions of people simple unemployment benefits.
Yep.
And he got shot down for that, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
And the filibuster got shot down for that too, didn't he?
Yeah,
it's not gone, but I mean, people are really looking at it now.
It drew a lot of attention.
It did. And they hate that too. They
Well, Bunning has been, you know, pretty weird guy even when he was playing baseball. You know, I used to see him pitch for the Phillies.
Oh, really?
When I was young, yeah. You know,
was he weird back then?
Yeah, he was nasty.
Really?
He was a nasty guy. He had that reputation.
Oh.
He was a good pitcher, but he had that reputation.
Wow. And,
you know, it's a shame.
Well, no wonder he became a politician then.
You know, for us baseball fans, it's a real shame that the first and only baseball Hall of Famer to serve in the United States Congress is such a
beep. Well, we're coming about to the end of the show, Paul. So the pressing things are, the website for the democracy in California is?
CA4D.org, California for Democracy. And in fact, I think you can get to the website by typing that all out using the number 4.
Okay. And the other one, and the other pressing issues were?
March 20th in San Francisco, noon at the Civic Center. Join people from all around the Bay Area.
Peninsula Peace and Justice got buses going up there or shuttles or anything?
Yeah, there will be a bus that we're sharing with San Jose Peace and Justice Center. It's going to come up 280 and stop at the Arrastradero park and ride.
Okay.
And so this works pretty well. So
people can go on the Peace and Justice website?
Check our website, peaceandjustice.org, and that and everything else is there. Check the calendar because there's always lots of stuff going on around here.
And you got a TV show tomorrow night?
No, we're beyond that. Next one will be in April, and I don't have a guest yet. So,
all right,
nothing to talk about there. So come to the march and rally, and then we'll figure out where we go from there.
Paul, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me in again, Bert.
Stay in touch, and you'd keep up all the great work, too.
Thanks, you too.
Thank you. That's Paul George of Peninsula Peace and Justice.